It's kind of like I'm asking you about your job. So you've been miserable in your job, and well, you have lots of talents, you know. Why are you staying there? So when we take marriage as sort of like your job, there's no moral commitment. I mean, when you took your job, you didn't say for life, right? And so if you're unhappy long enough, or you have a better option somewhere else, you move on. We've taken marriage in the same way.
This is our first launching episode of Stronger Marriage Connection, so we decided to kick things off with one of the nation's leading scholars and marriage therapists. The one and only Dr. Bill Dougherty from the University of Minnesota joins us as we discuss what marriages are like today, what commitment looks like in the 21st century, and what it takes to create an intentional marriage. Our guest, Dr. Bill Dougherty, is a professor in the Department of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. A longtime marriage and family therapist, he's an expert on challenges couples face, on navigating marital crisis and avoiding divorce, and on using family rituals to enhance the quality of family life. His books include The Intentional Family and Take Back Your Marriage. In recent years, Bill has taken his couples work to the national level via co-founding Braver Angels, an initiative working to decrease the political polarization that is dividing the country. Among his awards is the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Family Therapy Academy. I have a feeling you're going to love this first episode, so enjoy the show. Welcome to Stronger Marriage Connection, my friends. My name is Dr. Dave. I am a professor here at Utah State University, alongside a wonderful co-host, Dr. Liz Hill, a licensed psychologist. We are dedicating our life's work, our research, and our practice to really helping bring the best relationship tips and practices and the best research to you to help you have the marriage of your dreams. And today, I'm super excited for today's episode. This is kind of our big launch episode, and we decided to bring in just one of the big home run hitters, one of the great scholars of our time, great author. Bill, am I doing good here? Just keep going.
Yeah, home run. That's great.
Yeah, this is great. We're wonderful. So grateful to have Dr. Bill Dougherty from the University of Minnesota on with us. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Great. Home run. You know, I see myself more as a utility player. You know, I can play a lot of different positions, but I'll take the home run slugger. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we appreciate that you're such a fan of the Utah Marriage Commission, Bill. Thank you for that and the support you've given us through these 24 years. It's just such an honor.
Well, you guys have been pioneers, and I've been just happy to support in any way I've been able to.
Thank you. You know, we wanted to start today, Bill, with we hear so many numbers about the divorce rate, right? Currently, I've heard it as low as 38-40% to maybe as high as 50% with first marriages. I don't know. Are we in the right ballpark? Is that correct? Is that what you're understanding today? What is the divorce rate?
Well, it's actually more complicated than the overall figures. The divorce rate for college educated people has gone down substantially in the last 10 or 15 years. It hasn't gone down for working class people and poorer people. But the overall divorce rate is lower. But the big news is the difference in the social class aspects of it. There's something happening with college educated folks and with millennials. So the divorce rate for each generation after the baby boomers has gone down. And so the good news is we're maybe learning some things here about how to make marriage work better than the baby boomers learned.
That's really good news if that's the case. Thank you for clarifying that. We're really happy to be able to pass along correct information. We've also heard you say we need both boundaries and intimacy in marriage, Bill. There is danger in acting like an expert, right? An expert marriage therapist and diagnosing our partner. Sometimes we can get just enough information to be dangerous, right? That's a problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, this, I'm glad we're talking about this because I've seen it in my couples therapy practice and in my own life. There's a lot of pluses in reading self-help books, going to webinars and so on, you know, as an individual to learn about marriage, about marital communication, about improving oneself as a spouse, all good. Yeah. but there's a downside that can happen, that we can come to feel that we have more relationship expertise than our spouse. And then we let them know that, thank you. And so you can get into this sort of teacher-student dynamic. So there's so many people, and if we're clear about it, women tend to, on average, be more interested in this relationship stuff, what's new, and read more and so on. And then they do things like hand the book over to their husband to say, here, this would be good for you to read. And about 99% of the time, the guy doesn't read it.
Okay. Imagine now, that.
A, because that. Maybe this... I'm sure that's not true in Utah, but here in Minnesota, the guys don't read it. And some of it is that it's less maybe intrinsically interesting to him. But the other part is it feels like an assignment.
Yes.
Okay. And so we tend to resist that from our spouses. So that's one thing, that the too much knowledge that we feel like we're going to pass on. It's not like you've learned how to fix a car better or something, you know, or, you know, prepare souffle better. Okay, that's more neutral. This is knowledge about us, my spouse, okay? And that's number one. And then the second one is that when people do learn to kind of self-assess themselves more and kind of have more insight into themselves, which is all good, they can do the same uninvited with their spouse based on what they've learned. Okay. First, so like attachment styles are really big nowadays. So maybe then I say, gee, I've read about this and I realize I have a kind of an anxious attachment style given my family. And I know my wife's family and I know her. So I'm going to offer that label to her. And what I'm saying is if she is actually healthy, she's going to say, excuse me, because I am now playing like the therapist. So it's really important that as we get closer to one another in marriage, our boundaries have to be really, really solid. Really solid. What I mean by boundaries is respecting the autonomy, the privacy, the right to have her own thoughts, and not to have me be the expert on my spouse. So, you didn't use an iMessage there, my dear. I've learned to use iMessages. You see what I'm saying? All kinds of examples.
Whoa,
so intimacy, the closer we are, the better the boundaries we have to have.
Yep, staying in our own lane,
That's
Bill?
Great, Bill. Yeah, it
is. Stay in our own lane. You know, because we are so we can be so self-serving in marriage, even if we're not aware of it, right? That we use our knowledge in a self-serving way.
Guilty is charged. Yes.
Yeah.
Guilty is charged at times.
me as well. So learning is good, right, Bill? I mean, you know, reading and assessing, but then it's where it comes to be, I think you need this because I've discovered my personality style and you're a red and you're trying to either diagnose or kind of preach down. It's almost like parenting your partner in a way, isn't it?
Yes.
Exactly. Okay, you're giving me your thoughts, but not your feelings. Tell me how you feel. And then your poor spouse comes out with something that's not a feeling statement, and so you pronounce that they got that wrong. when they haven't signed up for you to be their teacher.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it gets easy for marriage educators and counselors to make this mistake because in our role, people come to us because they like to be educated, like to be, you know, they like to learn some things. So it's all fine there. It's all fine if you want to learn how to communicate better and I say, tell me how you feel, and then you give me a thought statement instead of a feeling statement. Well, we have an agreement in our relationship that I can say, actually, Dave, that was more of a thought. So I'm interested, feeling words like, you know, you're mad, you're scared, you're happy, you know, as opposed to what you think about it. So could you try that again? Hey, if we have that relationship, you just say, hey, Bill, good, thanks. I'm wanting to learn something. But in a family, in a couple, That is, it comes across as a power move. It's controlling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure is.
We'll be right back after this brief message.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Well, let's dive right in. Bill, with this first episode, as we launch this podcast, we're kind of talking, you know, big picture as well as some personal examples and what that looks like. Thinking about commitment today, you know, right? Yeah. Marital commitment in the 21st century. What does that look like today for couples?
Well, yeah, this is one of my big interest areas that, in fact, my daughter and I have a website called moderncommitment.com. And so commitment now become much more something that individuals have as opposed to the whole social environment around you expecting it. You know, historically marriage was not so much just a personal relationship, it was a relationship between two families, extended families. It was based in a community. It was based on the idea that when you get married, that's it for life. I mean, you don't look for doorways out, and everybody around you knew that. And now it's much more, it's very personal. So think about weddings now, so many weddings. The brides and grooms make up their own vows. I mean, that's sweet, but it's very idiosyncratic. I mean, some of them get a little weird, you know, like the dog is included. I don't know. I'm just, but we live in an age where we celebrate individual kind of autonomy and creativity. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have and we expect a lot more out of marriage than we did historically, right? So the bar is higher. We expect this is to be my best friend, my soulmate, you know, I have to feel understood and blah, blah, blah. And historically people didn't feel that. Somebody who respected you, who cared for you, who loved you and who was a good parent and, you know, but now we expect all the psychological stuff. So the problem then is we're more individualistic, we're less community-based. We have very high expectations, and unless commitment at a moral, ethical level is big, a big part of this marriage, I'm going to feel disappointed in some way because my spouse cannot possibly live up to the cultural ideals. Mm-hmm. And then we have kids and jobs and all that. So I'm going to deal with the gap between my ideal and the reality. Individualistic era, commitment is based more on sort of personal choice and not kind of moral, you know, religious dimensions. Mm-hmm. The commitment can start to falter. So it has to be strong in there. So part of what I've been writing as sort of a criticism, but also a suggestion for my colleagues in the field of marriage and family therapy is that we talk about relationships, attachment, intimacy, communication. Mm-hmm. We don't talk enough about commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can kind of set people up. This goes back to my earlier point about too much knowledge can be a dangerous thing in a marriage. We can raise expectations for what we want out of marriage, and that's good. But unless we have commitment, and here I'm talking about a moral, ethical commitment, we can actually destabilize marriages. Because you see what I'm saying? Because the expectations go so high. And we're all flawed, so we don't live up to them.
That's right, we are. So this is the ethical dimension that you're writing about, right? That not only about traditional steadfastness, but then a willingness to maintain and repair the marriage as needed.
Exactly. Correct? So I think modern commitment means, and I wish we put this into the vows, that if we run into trouble in our marriage, that we will make every effort to repair and restore. Mm-hmm. Every effort. We will, neither of us will walk just, you know, because it's gotten bad. We will seek help from our community, from if we're a religious person, from our congregation, from helpers, from therapists. We will do everything that we can. Just like if we have a child who becomes ill, we would do everything to help that child be restored to health. Do we feel the same way about our marriage?
I love those new vows. Isn't that brilliant? You know, you mentioned that what we learn in psychology, self-help books, and from individual psychotherapy, even in marriage therapy itself, can be damaging. Can we talk more about that? The distinction between helpful marriage therapy and harmful marriage therapy, please.
Well, this has been a bug of mine for many, many years, in part because I keep running into couples in therapy who have had some bad experiences in therapy before. Yes. Plus, in my own family life, my own friendship life, people getting undermined, their marriage is undermined by the therapist. Uh-huh. Not that any therapist wakes up in the morning and says, "I'm going to go out and undermine marriages."
Yeah.
But two things I want to say. First is that most people go to individual therapy and talk about their relationship problems. They're feeling depressed. They're feeling anxious. They go to a therapist, and among their concerns is their marriage. Okay.
Partner.
And it's because it's scarier to go to a couples therapy. So a lot of conversations about marriage and relationship issues go on in individual therapy. And I've just seen so much undermining. And now I have a new study that's just out. In the Journal of Family Process, where we surveyed 100 people across the country about their experience in individual therapy. And we asked them about questions such as, how often did your therapist say that your marriage was doomed from the beginning? That there's not much chance now for it to make? That your spouse will never change, not having met that person, to a psychological evaluation of that person, a label, having never met them.
Yep, a diagnosis.
And the last one was diagnosis was the therapist, again, not having met your spouse, says that your divorce is probably your best option. Those go on a lot.
Heartbreaking.
A lot. So let's take the one about diagnosing. When I give presentations to therapists about this, they kind of go, what husbands get as a diagnosis from the therapist, never having met the guy, what men get is narcissistic personality, right?
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, narcissistic, into themselves, right.
Yep.
Or they get, maybe he's on the autism spectrum.
There we go.
Because he doesn't open up with his feelings.
Guilty.
Okay? Uh-huh. And what women get when a man goes to therapy, complains about his wife, she gets borderline personality disorder, up and down, emotionally dysregulated. Yeah. One day she's loving, the next day she's mad. So I tell my therapist about this in a very self-serving way, where I leave out what I'm doing to get her so upset, right?
Yeah.
And then the therapist says, have you ever really thought about your wife in terms of borderline person? Do you know what? I can give you some literature on that.
Oh, boy.
And I swear, many of us, at our worst, if our spouse got a hold of some description, many of us would look that way some days, at our worst, right? Narcissistic, a borderline. Borderline. You know, and so and we're having some fun with this now, but people do get undermined. And what we found in our study was that the presence of these comments from the therapist, as reported by the client, are associated with poorer outcomes of the therapy and more likelihood of divorce.
Oh, man. Makes me kind of feel sick to my stomach because I remember statements. I remember statements like this. Bill and Dave, I have to admit, yep, guilty. Guilty as charged. Try not it's to be. So I know better. I know better, but oh, man.
Yeah, so listen, bad. Glad you said that. I really appreciate your openness on that because everybody has made these mistakes. And part of what we say is the pull towards taking the side empathically of your client. And their spouse is a distressing figure in their life. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's very tempting to buy their side of the story and to see their spouse as a two-dimensional figure.
Yeah. You know what it
it's
is,
very
Bill?
Tempting.
It's titillating. It's titillating, you know, when I get caught up in that storyline, right? Oh
yeah. And your client in some ways likes it because you're confirming his or her assessment that it's mostly the other person. My daughter Elizabeth has a great name for this kind of therapy. It's poor baby, what a jerk therapy.
You
put up with all that. And then what happens is we don't then challenge the client about their participation in this, okay? Their contributions to these patterns that go on. And I think then we don't help them as much. Now, in terms of couples therapy, the new study we're doing now is with people who've been in couples therapy. And the good news is there's fewer of those damaging comments, but it's still happening in, 15-20% of the couples where the therapist says things like, divorce may be your best option. Pulls one aside to give them the diagnosis of the other. There's still stuff that goes on. And our evidence, again, is the presence of these kinds of comments is associated with more divorce and with poor outcomes of therapy. Oh, and one more. This is a real bugaboo of mine. Somebody goes for help. So one of the spouses is in individual therapy. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the therapist says, gee, talk to your spouse about getting couples there, getting help. Okay. You finally talk your husband or wife into getting help. So who do you see? You see the individual therapist of one of them. So it's often the wife. She's in therapy. She gets her husband. You get him in to see her therapist with her. And I'm talking about you've been going for 2 years to this person who has basically bought that narrative usually. And our new study, we haven't written this up yet, found higher divorces occurring simply on the basis of going to see one of their therapists opposed to somebody who's more neutral. Hmm. Isn't that something?
That is powerful.
And so last night I was watching the Ted Lasso TV, which is, he's gotten all kinds of awards.
Yeah.
He's a soccer coach. Okay. And I'm watching this episode and there's a player who's got some psychological issues. And the recommendation is to bring in a sports psychologist and do some therapy with. And the coach, Ted Lasso, is saying, I'm not so sure. And so his colleague says, what's your concern? He said, I'm not so sure about therapy. Why? And then he said that when his own marriage was in trouble, he saw his wife's therapist for couples therapy. And he said, and I felt like I was ganged up on. It was all my fault, and it was a really bad experience. So that was written by a screenwriter who has had that experience.
Yes.
That wasn't somebody's creative, right? That's all the time out there.
Wow. It breaks my heart.
Man, Bill, it is. It's sad. Let me turn, Bill, to this. We've done a study here in Utah because we think that most people, they want a genuine desire connection. In fact, the title of our podcast, Stronger Marriage Connection, we did that intentionally. Mm-hmm. So we surveyed Utahns. It turns out 67% of the respondents in the survey, they say they agree that they expect to be married to one partner for life. So about two-thirds expect to be married to one partner for life. And I have a daughter, our oldest, so our first marriage in with our children. She was married this past summer. And of course, she, like all the others, expect to be married for life. So how, this is kind of a big question. How do they make that happen? How do they really get this good start off in their relationship, and how do they keep it going?
Well, the term I like to use is being intentional, having an intentional marriage. I lived in Minnesota at the headwaters of the Mississippi River, and they say that getting married is like putting a canoe into the Mississippi River. If you don't paddle, you go south.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pace of life, the busyness of life, the distraction of life inevitably starts to draw energy out of a marital relationship, particularly because we expect so much of those, right? Mm-hmm. You get married at a kind of a peak of the coupleness.
That's right.
And then that lasts for a little while. You start to have kids and jobs and all that. And a relationship that was based on a one-to-one, personal connection, now you're running a small family business called raising kids and trying to make a living. Yeah. And you're more side by side than this way, face to face. And so you have to have intentionality, mindfulness to maintain and build your marriage, because otherwise you will experience more distance over time, which could be okay. It doesn't mean you have to break up, but in this more fragile era, mm-hmm. you can't afford to neglect your marriage. You can't afford
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember Dennis Rainey once said, he called it the natural float to isolation. If you're not consistently paddling together, or even have those mm-hmm. Canoes tied together, then you'll naturally, you don't even have to be mean and nasty. You just kind of right. naturally mm-hmm. drift apart.
Right. Huh. right. Most divorces do not occur to high conflict couples. That it's a mistake that people think that majority of divorces, according to the studies, occur to couples with lower or moderate levels of conflict. So they're not just at each other's throats, but they drift apart.
Yeah.
And then in an individualistic era, you can start to talk to your friends and others who say some version of you could cut a better deal somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
And then a key point, and this goes back to the ethical part, because I think you can ruin and destroy almost any marriage by focusing on what you're not getting.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Focus there. Point out to your spouse as frequently as possible how they're not meeting your needs.
Yep.
And then you elicit defensiveness, withdrawal, antagonism, whatever their worst part is, whether they just mm-hmm. withdraw from you or get mad back, whatever that is, you will invite them to bring their worst self.
Yep.
And then you double down on that. And then within a year or two, you are on the brink of divorce. Mm-hmm. And by the time you're on the brink of divorce, you are actually miserable. I mean, most people just don't wake up one day and say, I'm a little unhappy. Most mm-hmm. people who file for divorce are miserable. But what got you there?
Mm-hmm.
And if what got you there is what I call consumer marriage, and that is, what am I getting out of this as opposed to what am I putting into it and what are we putting it together? Okay. If you take a consumer approach to marriage, you don't work on it because I expect my vehicle, my car to start. I spent a lot of money on it. Okay. I'm the consumer. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have to put in work mm-hmm. every day to maintain the darn thing. The automaker should do that. Occasionally I get it fixed. So I don't have to work on the marriage, but I'm not getting my needs met. I let my spouse know, and we start to go down and down and down. And so by the time I open up to a friend about how miserable I am, my friend or my therapist might want to take me out of my misery by getting rid of the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely preventable.
Or maybe even out of their misery, right, Bill? Sometimes I think family members want us to be happy. Like, please get divorced so I can feel better.
Exactly. Well, this is another area of my research and practice is I call marital first responders.
Yeah.
That we have research showing that people turn to a friend, a sibling, somebody, a peer when they're having relationship problems. That's where they go first. And sometimes they get support and sometimes they get undermining. So like one of the most undermining questions would be, so Liz, are you happy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I really can't say that. Then mm-hmm. I don't know why you would want to stay.
Yeah.
Or do you really love him anymore?
That's a good one. Know.
Well, very complicated feelings, right? That's when you're upset in your marriage. Yep. And then you say, what does that tell you then? What does that tell you? Right. And it's kind of like I'm asking you about your job. So you've been miserable in your job and you have lots of talents, you know, why are you staying there? So when we take marriage as sort of like your job, there's no moral commitment. I mean, when you took your job, you didn't say for life. Right. And so if you're unhappy long enough or you have a better option somewhere else, you move on. We've taken marriage in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So are you happy? Do you love him or her? I think you deserve better, right? Deserve is the other word that comes in. You deserve better.
Here's another one. I call this an unforced error. It happens. So you're my sibling and you say, you know, I'm thinking I've just decided I'm going to leave Joe, Mary Sue. And then I say, we never did like her. Okay. I never thought you guys were compatible.
Okay. That's powerful.
Well, then they're lovebirds again in another week, and you can't take it back. So people can look up maritalfirstresponders.org, maritalfirstresponders.org, and we have a little training program on how to be a good confidant to people in your life who are having relationship problems.
That's for all of us, not just therapists. I love it.
We need more of those.
Yeah. Because we're all anybody who is a natural confidant, people open up to you.
Yeah. That's powerful.
Well said.
Bill, I have to bring this up because I read this book, Take Back Your Marriage, one of your several books. I'm going to show it on the camera. And this is, I read this as a graduate student, right? I think it was at Auburn University. I'm getting my PhD. And this was one of those game changers with the intentionality. You're bringing up intentionality. You talk about rituals. What motivated you to write the book?
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Yeah. That's the second edition that she's got that updated.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
So, what motivated me to write it is partly personal because one of the ways that my wife and I have been intentional about our marriage is that we developed what I call marital rituals early on, even when our kids were really little. We didn't have a lot of money, but we would invest in babysitters and we'd have a date at least every other week. Uh-huh. And we had our favorite restaurant. We even had our favorite table. and so we never lost the dating that we had. Most people fall in love through dating. I know it's an old fashioned term, but one-to-one time, you know, where you just get to know each other. Mm-hmm. And then we stopped doing it after we got married. So we also developed, I write about in the book, when our youngest is about four, an after dinner ritual where we would just, have some tea or something, and just visit with each other after the kids were, we fed them, they went off, and we spent 15 or 20 minutes in a daily conversation ritual.
Beautiful.
Just catching up with each other. So that's been important in my marriage. And there's a lot of research on family rituals, you know, family dinners and other kinds of things where that are bonders. So I wanted to write something then that wasn't about communication, conflict, sexuality, lots of books on those, good stuff. I wanted to write something about this intentionality, this approach to ritual. Bonding times that people have that they're committed to. What do you do for your anniversary, for example? Anniversaries occur like on a Wednesday, you know, when you got this kid as their concert at school and you got this and that and the other. And so do you just let it go or do you find another way to celebrate this? The birthday of your marriage.
It is.
Okay? And so there can be daily rituals and annual rituals. Yeah, so that's why my own experience and then seeing that for so many couples, this drift apart occurs because they don't spend time together.
Right.
in the way that they did where they fell in love. And I have a little story I tell in the book about a couple I was seeing in therapy who married 17 years, and they were really strikingly good-looking couple. They're just good-looking and athletic-looking. So, and I asked them how they met. And I was in Oklahoma at the time. And they met on a country western dance floor. And I said, oh, I bet you two were good. And they said, yeah, we were. And they told us that people used to form a circle around them and watch them dance.
Wow.
Okay, this very handsome couple. And then I said, innocently, I said, when was the last time you were dancing? 17 years ago at the wedding reception.
Darn it.
Wow.
Was the last time they went dancing. So here was some of the glue, and they let it go.
We'll be right back after this brief message. And we're back. Well, let's dive right in. Phil, I think it feels like today, in today's consumer marriage, it feels like that there are more distractions than ever before. You know, the phones, the electronics, and the TV. Instead of that 15 to 20 minutes, you know, sit outside on the deck and talk.
Yeah.
It feels like it's just, you just drift to a device, and that's our 15, 20 minutes. Instead of even watching a TV show or with the TV on, I see couples ones over here on the phone, scroll, instead of that intentionality.
Right. So, excuse me, part of what I teach about in the book is, well, how do you maintain a ritual? How do you protect the boundaries around the ritual? So over time, when my wife and I would have our after-dinner conversation over a little dessert, we evolved some ground rules. And that is that we did not do problem-solving conversation. We didn't say, okay, so the roof is leaking, those days, the yellow pages. So no logistical talk. There's time for that. It's more like, how's your day? How's your day been? You know, what's on your mind? You might say part of my day is worrying about that darn roof, but you don't follow up and say exactly what are we going to do with the roof. And so it's kind of like if you're getting together with a friend and you just check in with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're not trying to solve a problem with that person. Okay. You're checking with each other. So downloading what your day has been. And we also learned to avoid conflict, avoid arguments, because conflict undermines ritual. So families, for example, that have a lot of arguments at dinner table, you know, where the parents are coming down too hard on kids about their table manners, and it gets to be, you know, or they bring up their grades, the kids' grades, you know, so here's some more potatoes. I saw your report card. That's a mistake. Have your conversation later with your kid about the report card. Try to make the family dinner ritual more of a peaceful time. Same thing with a marital ritual, our daily one, or go out on a date. Because here's the temptation. If you haven't been around each other and you go on that date, somebody has a list of things. Now that I have you,
now I have your attention.
Undivided time here.
Yeah.
It's time for us to discuss blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's the best way to avoid having future dates.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So there's this irony about it that to have, quote, quality time together, ritualized time together, you have to have some buffers around that. You can't just be completely spontaneous. And when people go, oh, that's too structured, I say, okay, think about bedtime with your kid. You read a book, you cuddle, you talk, you maybe do a prayer, whatever. Yeah. Every parent knows that's not the time to say, you were obnoxious to your brother today, and we have to talk about what the consequences are going to be. Don't do that at bedtime. Everybody knows that intuitively. Okay. Yeah. Even if it's real on your mind, you don't ruin the bedtime that way. It's the same way about our marital communication. There are times to shelve what I'm unhappy about or what you didn't follow through on or whatever, and just connect.
remember that your boyfriend, girlfriend, right? We forget
exactly.
That. Forget
exactly.
Supporting and loving.
Treat them that way sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Right. But yeah. It's easier to do it when you're boyfriend, girlfriend, because you don't have all this other complexity.
That's right.
Okay. You're not making all of these decisions together. You don't have these responsibilities together, but you can carry through the elements of that.
Yeah.
You know, and so. After we moved to Minnesota, my wife and I got a hot tub, an outdoor hot tub. And so our new ritual was 10 o'clock at night or so. We want to sit in the hot tub together, out under the stars, and just relax together and visit. Lovely.
I love that. Love those rituals. You've reminded us so much about commitment. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is, Dr. Bill Daugherty, to have you on the show. And we're going to have you back again with another hot topic called discernment counseling, which is very near and dear to my heart. It's what do you do if you're on the brink of divorce? It gives couples such hope. Traditional therapy is not appropriate when one is leaning in and one's leaning out. So can't wait to have you back for that, Bill.
Looking forward.
Hey, Bill, before we let you go, we like to end each episode with a takeaway of the day, something that you hope that the listeners will really latch onto and remember and apply in their lives. What's your takeaway of the day from our conversation?
It's that you're a citizen of your marriage, not a consumer of your marriage. Okay. You're an active agent of shaping and building this relationship, which means being intentional about it and being rock solid committed.
Beautiful.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. Liz, what about you?
Yeah. Commitment. It was really on the top of my head. Just that note, come what may, right? Come what may. Commitment. I'm in this for the long haul. And that's going to be different for everyone, right? Everybody has their level I'm at a loss for a word. Maybe we'll just cut that out and just leave it at commitment. But can I ask you, Bill, don't people kind of have their own level of what they can stand? What's that called? Oh, anyway. So what are deal breakers for some people are not deal breakers for others. Is that true? Is it very individual?
Well, we can. Okay, well, when you say deal breakers, I actually consider that part of the consumer contractual marriage paradigm.
Pardon me. Yep.
Right. Now, I don't mean to.
I appreciate that.
Didn't mean to just. It's people use that phrase.
That's helpful.
But a deal breaker is like a contract.
Right.
And I got my part. You got your part. You're letting down your part. And so it's not. I remember a woman in therapy. She said, "It isn't the deal I thought I was signing up for." It never is. It never is. It's like parenting. What the heck? You know, you just don't know what the future is.
We don't know what we're signing up for, do we?
That's right. So maybe we could talk at another time about what I call hard problems versus soft problems.
Oh, yeah.
In marriage.
Yeah.
Hard
yeah.
problems called the triple A's, abuse, affairs, and addictions. Okay. So there can be a point in which you cannot accept any longer the chronic affairs of your spouse, and you've done all kinds of things to try to get help. Their addiction that's making them more and more irresponsible, or certainly abuse. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you just walk the first time anything happens,
right.
But there can be times in which you tragically cannot hold on to that commitment because the effect is so damaging. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. People have to give their kids over to foster care sometimes. I mean, life is filled with tragedies.
Yes. Okay?
but most of the divorces are for the soft problems, which are lack of communication, lack of intimacy. We argue too much together. Yeah. You better like how you spend the money. Most divorces nowadays are for the soft reasons, most of which are quite repairable.
Great reminder. Thank you on the consumer marriage. I needed that reminder.
Yeah.
What's your takeaway, Dave?
You know, I think it's been such a great conversation. I think my takeaway is the rituals of connection. That really resonates with me. My wife and I, even the way, you know, that we hold hands or three squeezes is kind of the I love you. You know, there's just things that we get each other and we intentionally do these things throughout some are daily. Some are, you know, a weekly ritual that we'll get together and do. So I think that the importance of rituals of connection to keep that connection strong. Well, Dr. Bill Daugherty, this has been such a pleasure. We sure appreciate your time. Hey, before we let you go again, Where can people go to find out more information?
Well, about what my daughter and I are doing, the Daugherty Relationship Institute, they could Google that to find out more of what we're doing. Also have a foundation, a family foundation we've created. That's where this Marital First Responders program is. It's all free, and it's DaughertyFoundation.org.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
We love
thank
you,
Bill. You so much for your time. Yep. Yeah, we sure
thank
appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Yep.
And thanks for those tuning in. We sure appreciate your support. We hope that you'll continue to listen to us, that you'll spread the word here at Stronger Marriage Connection. But for now, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today. Do us a favor and take a few minutes, if you haven't already, to subscribe to our podcast and the Utah Marriage Commission YouTube channel. Leave a review and share with a friend. You can also follow and message us on Instagram at Stronger Marriage Life and on Facebook at Stronger Marriage. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what topics you want us to explore or what you loved about today's episode. And don't forget to check out our website, strongermarriage.org, for show notes and more great resources from the Utah Marriage Commission for improving your relationship connection. Finally, a big thanks to Utah State University Extension, Rex Polanis, and the Utah Marriage Commission for producing each episode.